What I'm going to be talking about today is a little bit like my first lecture. I'll be going a bit into the reasoning involved in Austrian economics, but I'm going to give examples of mistakes in reasoning that come about through neglecting the lessons of Austrian economics. I'll also, toward the end of the lecture, I'll also be giving some examples of mistakes in philosophical reasoning of interest to libertarians, I hope. Now, you might object that the topic is everyday logic of economics, so I shouldn't be talking about philosophy, but I think there's sufficient connection between the subjects to justify talking about. Besides, it's my lecture. I always say I believe in academic freedom. If you don't agree with what I say, you're free to leave and go to a different class. They think I'm joking. Now, why did I say call this talk the everyday logic of economics? What's so everyday about Austrian economics? Well, Austrian economics uses ordinary logic, the kind of reasoning we all use in our everyday life. And the arguments that it uses are deductive. That's to say, it reasons from certain premises to a conclusion. And it's Austrian economics is conducted in ordinary language. If you look at the major books of Mises, if you look at Socialism and Human Action, in Human Action, there are no diagrams at all. I think there are a couple of equations, but they're so easy to follow that even I can follow them. And in Socialism, I think there's one diagram. So this is very much different from what you'll get if you look at mainstream books on economics, which it uses mathematics extensively. Say, if you look at an econometrics book, it looks like a railway timetable. You wonder what, you're waiting for your next train. You won't know what's going on. But Austrian economics isn't like that. And of course, the question would come up, why does Austrian economics use ordinary language rather than reasoning in mathematics? Well, in mathematics, you're concerned, you can analyze certain kinds of change. You can say if a variable changes in a certain way, something else will happen. And you can do this in very detailed way, say in calculus, you're analyzing changes in variables. But what one can't do in mathematics is do something that is basic to Austrian economics. In Austrian economics, what we're concerned with is the notion of human action. And human action involves doing something for a reason. You're acting for a reason. And this isn't something that is amenable to mathematical analysis. There's a very good book. I was just starting to read it by Eric Marcus called Rational Causation. It's very good on this topic. Marcus is a member of the philosophy department at this university. So I think but I just mentioned that because this is a basic reason we don't use mathematics, that we're concerned with action, which is doing something for a reason. And this we need, we're thinking about this concept, doing something for a reason based on our own knowledge of action in the ordinary world. So this is why we're using ordinary language. Now, how does economic reasoning work in the Austrian view? Well, we start from a true premise, which is human beings act. each of us knows this is true because you know in your own case that you're acting, you're using means to achieve ends, and you know that other people act. And as I mentioned in my praxeology lecture, we're not starting from some kind of skeptical standpoint where we have to think, well, all I know is my own consciousness, so how do I really know other people act as well? That isn't the starting point. We're right in the ordinary world in which we immediately grasp that we all act. So this isn't something that we're trying to justify. We're starting from this. And from this premise that human beings act, from this concept of action, we're trying to make explicit what's involved in any action using deductive reasoning. Now, what is the advantage? What is the great advantage of using deductive reasoning? Well, if we start with a true premise and then reason correctly, then the conclusion will be true. That's to say, we're starting with a true premise, we're following the laws of logic correctly, then the conclusion is true. We don't have to test out the conclusion any further. This is very much against the way the neoclassical mainstream economists work. They'll construct a certain mathematical model, and then they'll get conclusions, and they'll say, well, how do these conclusions match the actual world? If the model predicts that something will happen, how does this does the actual world conform to that? If, say, we arrive in our model that if the demand for a good increases, then the price will tend to go up. We can see, does this actually happen in the world? We can do tests and see what will happen. In the Austrian view, if you correctly deduced that other things being equal, the price will go up if the demand increases, you wouldn't need to do any further testing because it's been correctly deduced from a true premise. So another example, if we conclude from the nature of action that nature always chooses its highest valued end, we don't need to test this out. We don't need, say, to ask people to write out their preference scales at various points and then say, did you in fact choose at this time the preference that you ranked highest? We wouldn't need to do this kind of empirical testing because if our reasoning is correct, then the conclusion is guaranteed to be true. So now for this method to work, and by work, I mean that we come up with true conclusions, it's essential that we start from a true premise. Now, what happens if we don't? What if we start from a premise that isn't true? Then suppose we reason correctly, but the premise isn't true. Then it's not guaranteed that the conclusion will be true. Now, a mistake to avoid here, it isn't that if you start from a false premise and reason correctly, then the conclusion is going to be false. It's just that it's not guaranteed to be true. So the advantage is if you start with a true premise and then you reason correctly, then your conclusion will be true. But if you don't start with a true premise, then all bets are off. So if we're starting with the premise human beings act, so how do we know this is true? I've said it's true, but that doesn't make it true. You know, there's a character in Lewis Carroll's poem, Hunting of the Snark, who says, what I tell you three times is true. So I don't think that's a sound method of reasoning. So just from the fact that I said this doesn't mean it's true, doesn't follow that it's true. So in the Austrian view, the premise human being acts is self-evident. Now, what does that mean? What do we mean when we say something is self-evident? Well, what this means is that the truth doesn't depend on anything else. Say we started with this premise, human beings act, and then we deduce from that that people always choose their most highest value preference. So then you could say, well, how do you know people always choose their most highly valued preference? You say you've gotten it from this premise that human beings act. But if the premise human beings act is self-evident, then there wouldn't be some further premise that you're deducing human beings act from. You would just be taking this as a starting point. You're saying that when you think about this, it's immediately evident to you that the statement is true, that we see human being, the statement human beings act. So when we understand what this means, then we grasp that it's true. Now, I just say as a somewhat of a digression, although it isn't that much of a digression, some people have claimed that, and it sometimes happens this way, that if we deny a self-evident truth, then we're going to get involved in a contradiction. For example, suppose you deny that human beings act, taking this to mean that it's never the case that human beings act. So then, well, if you're saying that human beings never act, then you're acting yourself, so you're in some sense contradicting the premise. Now, that isn't whether that's true or not for denying that human beings act. Suppose you just took the denial to be that it's sometimes the case that human beings act, then I don't think you could raise that point. But regardless of that, it isn't a general characteristic of self-evident propositions that you're denying them will involve you in some sort of what's called a performative contradiction, that you're very denying the proposition somehow implies that the proposition is true. For example, suppose I say that 2 + 2 = 5. Of course, I wouldn't say that I'm bad in math, but I'm not that bad. So suppose I said 2 + 2 = 5. It wouldn't, so far as I can see, be the case that my saying that 2 + 2 = 5, which is denying that 2 + 2 = 4, that I could only say that if it were really the case that 2 + 2 = 4. You see, so I don't think it's in general a characteristic of a self-evident proposition that denying it leads to some sort of performative contradiction. That can sometimes happen, but not always. Now, another thing to note on self-evident propositions is very often when you grasp a self-evident proposition, you'll have a feeling of certainty. You say, oh, I see, it has to be true. Now I understand this. So when you say the statement is self-evident, you're not saying that the statement is true because you have this feeling, this kind of experience, this aha, I see it, this is how it has to be. If you said that, then you would be saying that the statement is true because of this feeling you had, and then it wouldn't be self-evident, it would be based on the feeling you had. So self-evident means it's not based on anything further. Now, let's consider an objection to what I've so far been saying. We won't consider the objection. What I've so far been saying is incomprehensible. I'm going to put that kind of thing aside. That wouldn't be very nice if anybody said that. So I'm going to hope nobody does. So the objection is, does Austrian economics really operate through common sense reasoning, as I've said it does? You might say, well, if you look at what Mises says and what various other writers on Austrian methodology have said. They talk about synthetic truth, synthetic a priori truth, the errors of a logical positivist movement. Now, that doesn't sound like ordinary common sense. That sounds like it's a pretty technical philosophical discussion. So if that's the case, how can I still say that Austrian economics operates through common sense reasoning? I think the thing to realize there is that philosophical issues like nature of whether Austrian economics uses synthetic a priori truths and so on are responses that Mises and other people had to attacks by various philosophers, especially the logical positivists, on praxeology, on the science of human action and the way the Austrians were conducting that. So Mises and others had philosophical responses to the people, the philosophers who attacked them. But in order to engage in economic reasoning, you really don't have to know these philosophical points. I mean, I hope you do because that keeps me in business, but you don't really have to know this. As long as you realize that the premises are true that Austrian economics is working with, such as that human beings act, that's all you need. You don't have to go into these issues of a priori truth and so on in order to understand what's going on. Now, I want to deal with another objection. As you can probably tell, I like objections, especially ones I think I can answer. Objections that I can't answer, I'm not so sure whether I like them, but I'll take them also. Now, suppose we just say, as I did, that the basic premises of economics are obviously true. Some people could say, and in fact, people have said this, that this attitude goes against science, that it very often happens in science that science will overthrow certain beliefs that we think are obviously true and show that they're not true as well. For example, it doesn't seem to us now that the Earth is moving. It seems that it's standing still. So wouldn't the view that the Earth is really revolving around the sun is one that goes very much against common sense, but it's one that we have very good reasons, scientific reasons, to accept. I must say, I don't know what they are, but I'm taking it by following the epistemological division of labor that other people have established this correctly. So even though it seems to us that the Earth is stationary and it isn't, so somebody might say, well, you're saying in economics we can just start with common sense knowledge, but common sense is often wrong. You know, in this connection, in George Bernard Shaw's play, St. Joan, there's a line, I think, where someone says, someone wonders whether the sun moves, and someone says, of course it does, can't he use his eyes? But so sometimes things we think are obviously true turn out not to be. So I think the an answer here is that examples like that show that we just have to be careful in our reasoning from common sense, from beliefs we claim think are self-evident, that they're self. The argument, we sometimes make mistakes, therefore every single one of our beliefs is possibly mistaken, isn't a good one. Suppose, as it does, it I claim it to be self-evident that human beings act. It isn't a good reason to reject that, that other people have had beliefs about things that seemed obvious to them that weren't. And one could, I don't want to go into a whole lot of details on this, but one could also raise differences between scientific examples like that and the kind we're concerned with human action, that the scientific ones really are just based on observations of the external world. But in when we're talking about praxeology, we're dealing with direct, immediate knowledge that we have of action. And it isn't clear what it would mean to say, well, some sort of scientific result would show we don't act, that we're all mistaken in thinking that, although there are people who do in fact say that, but I don't find it clear, their views all that clear. Now, with all that, that's been the rather abstract. Now I want to get into some concrete examples of mistakes in economic reasoning, so we can see what happens if you don't use don't follow praxeology, you don't reason very carefully in this deductive way from premises we know to be true. Well, you'll often see arguments like this, that China and other countries in Asia have very high economic growth rates, but they have at the same time extensive state intervention in the economy, even though China has liberalized very considerably from the communist regime in the past. It's not a laissez-faire capitalist economy. So people say, well, if China is doing well with extensive state intervention, doesn't that show that the people such as the Austrians who say the way to prosperity is to have a complete free market, doesn't that suggest that they're wrong? Because look at China, other countries in Asia and elsewhere have extensive state intervention, but they seem to be doing pretty well. So, and again, another example, this is one that Paul Krugman, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, so what he says is obviously correct. So he points out, he emphasizes a lot, that the United States in the 1950s had higher growth rates than it does today, even though tax rates were higher than, at least on personal income, were higher than they are now. So he said, well, look, people today who say we shouldn't have very high taxes on the rich because this will stifle economic growth if you know you're going to be giving money, what the money you make is going to the government, you won't want to produce more. Those people are wrong because look what happened in the 1950s. This was a period of high economic growth, but the tax rates were higher then. So what is the problem here? We could raise problems about the particular claims they made, whether the statistical points they appeal to are correct, but there's a problem in the way they're reasoning. What these arguments say is that one thing, namely, or one state of affairs, prosperity, has gone together with another state intervention. But to say that isn't to establish a causal relationship. We don't know from the correlation that the intervention caused the prosperity. We don't say, in the Chinese case, we don't know that the fact that the Chinese are intervening in the economy or interfering with the free market has caused the prosperity. It could be the case that they would have had even better results if they'd had a freer market. So what the mistake here is, just to try to reason by establishing correlations rather than reason deductively from first principles in the way that's done in Austrian economics. So what could we suppose we want to do this? We want to reason from first principles. So what will happen? What kind of policy conclusions, if any, could we draw if we try to do this? Well, one principle that Mises stresses very much, and you'll find this in Frederick Bastiat and Henry Hazlitt also, is that when you're trying to consider the effects of a policy, you have to consider all the effects it has, not just the immediate or short-term effects. So you don't just consider what is the immediate result of the policy, but all the effects. Now, some people say, well, if you say that, that just means that you have a preference for the long run as against the short run. But what if somebody said, well, I care about the immediate results much more than the long run results. So if you say we should be concerned with the long run results, aren't you just importing your own personal preferences against mine? Isn't this arbitrary? So what Mises says there is he isn't claiming that thinking about the long run or taking account of the long run is better than taking account of the short run. Actually, I think he did think that, but he isn't arguing for that here. All he's saying is that the economist needs to take account of all the effects of a proposed policy rather than just some of them. And then what judgments you make about the policy or something else, but he's just taking it, I think, as a principle of rational action, that you should consider all the consequences of what you're doing, at least all the ones that you're aware of, rather than just take some of them. So somebody could actually prefer the short run. He could say with Keynes, in the long run, we're all dead. So this wouldn't go against immediately what Mises is saying, as long as the person was aware of the long run consequences. Now, I wanted to give an example. I made a mistake. One of my frequent mistakes should be an example of incorrect reasoning, not correct ones. I would give an F to the person who wrote that if it weren't myself. So now, one argument you'll frequently hear in favor of tariffs, that's taxes on goods imported into this country from foreign countries, is that unless a particular industry is protected by a tariff, it won't be able to meet foreign competition. And then if the industry collapses, this will cause unemployment for the workers in the industry. For example, unless we have high tariffs on cars coming in from Japan, then American auto manufacturers won't be able to compete with them. And won't it be really bad for the American economy if the auto plants have to close up and we'll have unemployment for all these workers? So what is wrong with that type of reasoning based on what I was just mentioning about Mises said about the considering all the consequences of an action is against considering just the immediate ones? Well, the argument that I've just given that says, well, if you have tariffs, if you don't have tariffs, then American firms that can't compete with a lower price foreign goods will go out of business or lose business, and the result will be unemployment. That's considering only the immediate effects of the tariff. Now, what happens if you consider the more than that? Well, if the tariff is imposed, then consumers will have to pay higher prices because if there weren't a tariff, then they'd be able to buy the lower priced foreign goods, say if they have the tariff on cars, then they're going to have to pay a higher price for cars than they otherwise would have. So if they have to pay a higher price on cars, that will decrease what they can spend on other things and will thus decrease employment from what it would have been in these other industries or that they would have spent the money on. It's exactly the same as in Bastiat's famous example, the broken window. Remember where someone breaks a window and then someone else says, well, this is going, fixing the window is going to cause an increase in prosperity because the owner of the store will have to pay to get it fixed. And then this will, the glass maker will, one who sells them the window will spend the money on further things. And Bastiat points out, well, but that's neglecting that if the window hadn't been broken, the person would have spent the money on other things. So it's the same point here. You see, if you didn't have a tariff, well, maybe the auto workers would have been unemployed, but you would have been spending, the people who had the money to spend on the lower price, who spent money on lower priced cars would have more money to spend on other things, and that would increase employment in those areas. Now, also, supposing people, what happens though when the people are buying the foreign cars, would say there's no tariff, people buy more foreign cars. So then it's true that money, American money will go abroad, but those who get the money will eventually have to spend it on products sold by American export industries. Otherwise, they'll just be holding balances of American money that they won't be able to spend because they would have to, if they wanted to spend goods in the, buy something in their own country, they'd have to exchange the American money for some their own currency, and then the person, whoever got the money, would have the same situation. So eventually you'd have to have spending on American goods. Now, notice that the argument I've just been giving that says, well, there are these other effects other than the immediate effect of people who losing jobs because the American industry can't compete with the foreign industry. I've said there's these other effects. This argument doesn't say that it's wrong to impose the tariff. That would be an ethical judgment, that what is done in economics is just to give the economic consequences of a tariff. So it's saying this is what's going to happen if you impose a tariff. Now, when you take a look at these consequences, then you can decide what to do. Now, economics doesn't make value judgments, as Mises very often stressed. Economics is a value-free science. So economics is not saying, here's what you should do or here's what you shouldn't do. It's just saying, these are the consequences of proposed policy measures. I should say here, this is a very important point to note, not that anything I said in my lecture is unimportant. That would be a self-contradictory statement, wouldn't it? It doesn't suggest this claim that economics doesn't make value judgments does not imply that there are no objective criteria for value judgment. Some people will think, well, economics doesn't make value judgment because according to economics, all our preferences are subjective, so there can't be objective judgments about what people ought to choose. That isn't a correct line of thought at all. It's just that whether or not there are objective criteria for value judgment, economics doesn't make them. So you're perfectly free to think that there are objective criteria for judgments of value. It's just the place to try to investigate that question isn't economics. Now, I want to give another example in which economic reasoning can help us if we're trying to analyze particular arguments. That's a very popular argument. Some people, including at least one American president, I won't say who he is, but he's now in office, have argued in this way, that higher taxes for the rich, such as, say, Bill Gates or Howard Buffett, wouldn't hurt them very much, because we know from economics that goods have a diminishing marginal utility. And this includes money. Say, when you're acquiring units of a good, like you're acquiring units of apples. I won't say acquiring ham sandwiches. I don't want to get into that anti-Semitic example. But say you're going to put the first unit that you acquire to your most highly valued use, the second unit to your next most highly valued use, and so on. So this applies to money as well. So then the argument is, well, if you consider the billions and billions of dollars some people have, then those people can't be getting much utility from the last amounts of money they're accumulating. What difference would it make to Bill Gates if we took away a couple billion from him? He'd hardly notice anything. So wouldn't it be a good idea if we're interested in maximizing utility? Wouldn't it be a good idea to take away some money from the extremely rich and redistribute it to the poor, because the poor don't have as many units of money, otherwise they wouldn't be poor. So if you give them money, they'll get higher utility from it. So you'll be increasing utility if you redistribute money from the rich to the poor. Now, what is the problem with this argument from the point of view of Austrian economics? Austrian economics doesn't use a concept of utility in which this argument makes sense, because in Austrian theory, utility is strictly a matter of ranking, where each person is ranking the units of a good according to their uses. Where I said before, the first unit goes to the most highly valued use, the next unit to the next most highly valued, and so on. So all you have is the system of ranking. You don't have any measurement. So it wouldn't, in the Austrian view, make sense to say, well, my most highly valued preference right now is giving this lecture, and my next most highly valued preference is running out of the room screaming, and I prefer the first one twice as much as the second one. So that wouldn't make sense. All we would have is, in the Austrian notion of utility, would be you'd be ranking the preferences. They'd be ordinal rankings. And even more, also, these rankings would just be rankings of a particular person. It wouldn't make sense to say, I rank my preference for giving the lecture ranks higher than your preference for listening to me. Because what your preference for listening to me would be something on your value scale. So you wouldn't make sense at all in the Austrian view to say, compare something on my preference scale with your preference scale. So applying this to the argument I mentioned on in favor of redistributive taxation, which is that because of diminishing marginal utility of money, then money to a rich person has much less utility than money to a poor person. So redistributing the money will increase utility. The problem from the Austrian point of view is that we can't, this doesn't make sense. We can't say my ranking for my 100th dollar is either above or below your ranking for your 100th dollar. There's no sense to that concept. Now, again, we're not making an ethical judgment that taxes on the wealthy shouldn't be imposed. We're just analyzing here an economic argument used to support such taxes. I think one of the first, very prominent, I don't think he was the first by any means, but a very prominent economist who used this argument on diminishing marginal utility, because of diminishing marginal utility of money, it's a good idea to take tax money by taking money from the rich, giving it to the poor, was Arthur Pigou at Cambridge. And I just mentioned in passing, there was kind of a funny story in claiming that in World War II, he was a communist agent. So you can see where this argument is coming from. But that's just a joke, so you'll have to laugh. Okay, so you see what the problem was with the argument that we don't have, at least in Austrian economics, we don't have such a concept of utility, so that's why we can't say that. I mean, you could have some other view of utility in which that would make sense, but it isn't a scientific notion of utility as Austrian economists use that concept. Now, what I've done so far is make kind of a very sharp distinction between ethical judgments and economic analysis. I've said economics doesn't make any judgments about policy. It tells you what the consequences of various measures are, and then it's up to you to think, given these consequences, what is it you want to do? But Mises had a very ingenious way, not really of bridging this gap, but a way that still observed this gap between economic analysis and ethical judgment, but he was still able to say a good deal about policies while remaining strictly descriptive. So how did he do that? Well, he said what an economist can do without abandoning value neutrality is to show that certain measures will either achieve or won't achieve the goal of their advocates. So suppose you could show that someone favors a certain policy and he favors this policy because he says it will achieve certain goals. So then you can make a strictly scientific part of strictly scientific analysis. You can say, well, will this policy achieve these goals? And if it won't, then you have a strong argument against it because you're saying, even from the point of view of those who favor the policies, then they won't achieve the goals. And one example is a famous example Mises gives is that of price control. Suppose that the government thinks that the price of milk is too high. And the government said, well, because of these high prices, poor people who need milk for their children or for themselves aren't able to buy enough. They can't afford the milk. So then the government, to try to remedy this, establishes a maximum price for milk, which is below the market price. So the idea here is, well, the poor can't pay the market price, so we'll just lower the price, and then the poor will be able to buy more milk. So what would happen if the government does this? Well, if the at a price below the market price, there is a greater quantity demanded at that price than suppliers are willing to supply. So the result would be there's even less milk available than before. The government says, we said we want to make more milk available to the poor, so we're lowering the price of milk. But as a result, there are more people want milk at the lower price, and the suppliers are less anxious to sell it at that price. So the result is less milk available. So we can see here the government has failed in the sense that its policy isn't achieving what the government itself wanted to achieve by this policy, because the government said we want lower prices for milk. By lower, I mean we want to help the poor by making milk more readily available to them, so we'll lower the prices, but lowering the prices wouldn't have that result. And so here's an example, Mises gives many others, other Austrian economists as well, where we're showing that a policy won't achieve the results that the policymakers want. So Mises says, well, if we're doing this, we can criticize an argument, a policy, without abandoning value neutrality, because we're just saying it will fail from the point of view of its own advocates. Now, in Murray Rothbard, in Power and Market, extended this point. He said there's another kind of criticism that economists can make of proposed policies without deviating, without abandoning value neutrality. He says sometimes you can show, you can go beyond showing that the proposed policy won't achieve a goal. You can show that the goal itself is self-contradictory or couldn't be achieved. And he gives examples. Suppose someone wanted absolute equality. Rothbard argues in a way I find quite convincing that you couldn't achieve that. That would be absolutely impossible to achieve absolute equality, because people's situations are always different in some respect. So you couldn't get to people exactly equal situations. That argument doesn't rule out other egalitarian measures, but it does rule out that one. So I now want to say in the remaining time, a little bit comments on mistakes in ethics. And I think these are the ones I'll be giving are of interest to libertarians. Now, I should mention, this is going to get me into trouble in certain circles, that some of these criticisms involve what I think to be mistakes in arguments by Stefan Molyneux. Now, when I, as you may know, I've been involved in a bit of controversy with him. I wrote a somewhat less than enthusiastic review of his book, and he and his followers were not pleased by this. Now, one thing that happened, I mentioned in my praxeology lecture, I just said I don't want to get into digression, otherwise I'm going to start talking about Molyneux's argument. A student who was in the virtual Mises University, you know, people can who can't come here can listen to the lectures they're available just by looking at the videos. So one student posted my comment on the Molyneux site that I said, he wondered why I was talking about him so much. So I want to say, if that person is listening, I think his name is, he didn't put his name, but it's Cody Hall. So Cody, if you're listening, make sure you get, you want to post this, make sure you get this right. Now, just as in economics, it's easy to make mistakes in ethical theory. And one such mistake involves the concept of universalizability. This is a very common test of ethical rules. You say something like, what if everybody did that? For example, I'll give you a famous case that Kant gives. Of course, he's the most evil thinker of all time, but never mind that. Supposing I need some money, so I come up to one of you, can you lend me a couple $100? I'll pay you back next month when I get more money. And you say, all right, I'll do it. So suppose I never intend to pay you back. I just have given you a lying promise in order to get money for myself. So what would happen, Kant asked, what would happen if you universalize that? You say, it's all right to make a lying promise in order to get money if I really need it. Well, then Kant says, look, that would make the institution of promising collapse, at least promises of that kind, because if it were the general practice that people who ask for money didn't pay it back, people wouldn't believe them when they said they promised to pay him back. So it would be self-defeating as a general rule to follow that practice of making a lying promise, and that you would ask for, that you want money, you intend to pay it back. So this, as I say, is a very common test in ethical theory. You say, what if everybody did this? But the mistake here is to think that an ethical obligation has to be one that all people can perform simultaneously at all times. I mean, it wouldn't be wrong, say, let's just consider the institution of making a promise. Like I say, I promise to do something. It wouldn't be a good argument against promising that, well, you couldn't really imagine people continuously engaged in promising at every single moment. They wouldn't be doing anything else. They'd just be promising to do various things. So that wouldn't be a good argument, because the ethical rule, if you're obligated to do something, that is an obligation on you. It doesn't by itself imply anything on what other people should do or prefer. Let's imagine, say, I borrowed money from you and I have an obligation to pay it back. That doesn't imply directly that you have to do anything, whether you're the person I borrow the money from or other people. It's just I have this obligation. Now, that doesn't change if you universalize this and say, anyone who borrows money has an obligation to pay it back. It's still each person who has the obligation is the one who has to do something. It isn't that other people have to do something or have to take some attitude toward that thing. So this is, I think, one of the mistakes that Molyneux makes. He said, for something to be an ethical rule, it has to be what he calls universally preferable behavior. It's not entirely clear what he means by this, but one of the things seems to be that everyone else has to either prefer it, or at least has to be the case that they could prefer that course of conduct. So that isn't, I don't think it's a proper way of looking at universalizability. It isn't the case, say, that if I'm obligated to do something, you have to have some particular attitude or preference for it. I mean, he may be thinking of something like a sort of a strongly Pareto optimal state of affairs, where everyone prefers a certain state of affairs to some other state of affairs. Now, those are very nice states of affairs, but they're not required for ethical obligations. So what would be another good example? I mean, supposing, say, someone has robbed a bank and the sheriff has an obligation to arrest this person, even if the person resists by force. So suppose the, you could just consider the obligation. He has to bring in the criminal who's resisting. So there, by the way the problem is set up, the criminal who's resisting couldn't prefer being brought in, at least, I mean, might come up with some ways of taking where he could, but sort of commonsensically, he couldn't prefer being brought in, otherwise he wouldn't be resisting. But it doesn't follow from that that it's wrong to say the sheriff's under an obligation to bring in the resisting criminal just because the criminal couldn't prefer that state of affairs. So you see what the mistake is, that you're to think that everybody has to prefer or ought to prefer what you're doing if you're actually obligated to do something. Now, another mistake, and this will be the last one I'll be talking about, unless, of course, you consider the whole lecture a mistake, is when you ask, what if everybody did that, or you come up with some universalizable statement based on what you did, that's a test of whether what you're doing is morally all right. But the mistake is it doesn't follow from this that when you do something, you're implicitly accepting a rule that universalizes what you're doing. Now, this is, I want to be a bit careful. This is very, I think, a very important mistake to avoid, but it's easy to make. Supposing, say, I actually did borrow money from one of you and I didn't intend to repay it. So I wouldn't, in doing that, show that I accepted a rule, it's all right to borrow money from people even if you don't intend to give it back to them. That would be a way, this universalizing my conduct would be a way of testing whether what I did was morally all right. But I wouldn't, in doing it, be adopting any such maxim. I wouldn't have to be adopting some such maxim. Maybe I think, in fact, it's wrong to do it, but I just need the money, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. People very often do things they shouldn't do or don't think they should do. But people make this mistake. For example, Stefan Kinsella has what he calls an estoppel argument, which is something like this. Suppose you violate somebody's rights, like say you initiate force against them, then you show that by doing so, you accept the principle, it's all right to initiate force against people, so then you can't complain if other people do it to you. But you're not, in initiating force against somebody, accepting that principle. I mean, you might be, but you don't have to be. You could, just from the fact you're doing something, doesn't show you accept as an ethical principle, some universalizable generalization of what you're doing. And you find this, as one might expect, in Molyneux. He says, a thief is contradicting himself because he's saying that he's stealing. So he's saying, well, it's the other person's property, but he's claiming it for himself. So he's saying it's morally all right to steal other people's property, but that doesn't follow at all. So again, let's hope Cody's gotten this all down right. So I'm out of time now. So thanks very much.